Chapter 4 Scarlet Ribbons. The conditions of bourgeois democracy very often compel us to take a certain stand on a multitude of small and petty reforms. But we must be able to take such a position on these reforms that 5 minutes of every half-hour speech are devoted to reforms and 25 minutes to the coming revolution. V.I. Lenin. On the 14th of February 1917, after an extended Christmas break, the Duma assembled for another year. At a time of mounting popular disturbance, and with several of its members engaged in covert plots to oust the Tsar, the session should have been a lively one. Instead, as a stalwart of the progressive bloc put it, the deputies seemed to be wandering about like emaciated flies. No one believes anything. All feel and know their powerlessness. The silence is hopeless. The Duma's chairman, Mikhail Rodchenko, conceded that the mood was sluggish and the speeches dull. Progressive, liberal, or monarchist, the intellectuals vied to find fresh outlets for their shared despair. They were not alone in feeling powerless. Outside the pompous meeting hall, the mood was no more positive among the leaders of the revolutionary underground. Not one party was prepared for the great upheaval, remembered Nikolai Sukhanov. Then 35 years old, and working semi-legally as a socialist and writer, everyone was dreaming, ruminating, full of foreboding, feeling his way. The atmosphere was different across the water, where the workers lived. Few people there had time to ponder their foreboding dreams. The food crisis was now acute. The wealthy could still have their fresh white bread in any restaurant, but families in the factory districts had begun to starve. It was not just a question of inflation, although the prices of everything from kerosene to eggs had multiplied beyond the reach of the hard-pressed. The real problem in Petrograd, exacerbated by a transport crisis in the provinces, was a shortage of grain. The city's wheat and flour stocks, already depleted, had fallen by more than 30% in January, leaving many without bread at all. Before the war, as an Okhrana agent reported, a bakery could sell 10,000 rolls a morning. But now, the 8,000 that it produced on a good day were sold within 2 hours. It was not uncommon for a woman who managed to procure 2 loaves to cross herself in prayers of tearful gratitude. Resentment is worse in large families, an agent informed the secret police, where children are starving and where no words are heard except peace, immediate peace, peace at all costs. The government's response might have been scripted for a modern Marie Antoinette. To help conserve scarce flour stocks, the Commissioner of Food Supplies prohibited the baking and sale of cake, to say nothing of buns, pies, and biscuits. There were also new restrictions on the provision of flour to factory kitchens and workers' canteens. The move had little impact on the bread supply, but working people greeted it with rage. Because they had no legal share in government, few even had a vote, the only thing that they could do was join a protest, usually a strike. The atmosphere became so tense, like living on a volcano, decided Paul Milyukov, that some suspected the shortage to have been engineered. The more hysterical imagined an exotic German plot, while others detected a scheme to provoke riots and thus pave the way for mass arrests and tyranny. But there was comfort in the thought that the most obvious discontent was economic. Such strikes as might occur, a telegram from Sir George Buchanan reassured the British War Cabinet on the eve of the Duma's new session, would be primarily on account of the shortage of food supplies. But it was not considered likely that any serious disorders would take place. What Sir George had failed to understand was that bread itself was political. In factories and engine sheds, in shipyards and workers' barracks, socialist activists were using hunger as a means to start a conversation with the people. Leaflets, speeches, and slogans connected the food shortage to the war and the autocracy. Bread might have been their immediate grievance. But once the people joined a strike, they were swept on by rousing songs and revolutionary catchphrases. On the 9th of January 1917, the anniversary of the Bloody Sunday Massacre of 1905, the strikes were explicitly political. When the Duma convened on the 14th of February, the Masryonka and its allies called the workers out again, this time with slogans about peace, democracy, and even a republic. There had been large-scale strikes before, but these were new and called for more from government than cake and buns. Even a patrician outsider could pick up the change of mood. At a bakery on the Litany this morning, Palaiolog wrote in his diary on the 6th of March, or the 21st of February by Russia's calendar, I was struck by the sinister expression on the faces of the poor folk who had lined up in a queue, most of whom had spent the whole night there. The peace of Petrograd depended on its civil governor, Major General A. P. Bulk, on the police, a force of 3,500 in a city of 2.5 million, and on the governor of the military district, Major General S. S. Kabalov. In charge of the coordination of them all was Interior Minister Protopopov, whose first resort, as crisis loomed, was to consult the ghost of Rasputin. His team was riven by mistrust. It was Bulk, for instance, who declared Kabalov to be incapable of leading his own subordinates. No one trusted the police chief, A.T. Vasilyev, whose promotion was entirely due to his friendship with Protopopov, and the best that anyone could say for Bulk was that he was good at his paperwork. None of this might have mattered, incompetence were nothing new in Russian government, if the troops Kabalov commanded had been the right men for the job. There were about 200,000 garrison soldiers in Petrograd, quartered in barracks all around the city centre. Most lived in conditions that felt like the serfdom their fathers had escaped. The only troops in the capital, remembered Alfred Knox, were the depot battalions of the Guard, and some depot units of the line, most of whom had never been at the front. They were officered by men who had been wounded at the front and who regarded their duty as a sort of convalescent leave from the trenches, or by youths fresh from the military schools. Palaiolog's source was a disaffected Russian general. In my opinion, this man had confided in November 1916, the troops guarding the capital ought to have been weeded out long ago. If God does not spare us a revolution, it will be started not by the people, but by the army. The general had got that wrong. The army played a crucial role, but only when the people had already kindled a revolt. It started with a celebration, albeit an imported and at times half-hearted one. The festival of International Women's Day had been created just before the war by a German socialist called Clara Zetkin. The event was marked in Petrograd on the 23rd of February, a few weeks after the annual commemoration of Bloody Sunday. In its first years, the comrades in the Russian Empire had been reluctant to make a special effort over Zetkin's festival, and some continued to dispute its propaganda value as the date approached in 1917. A march was planned, but it risked being small, as well as mostly female. We need to teach the working class to take to the streets, Shlepnikov wrote to Lenin. But we have not had time. He added several times that he'd also lost his printing press. The Bolsheviks could lead no one without a manifesto and a pile of pamphlets. But other factions saw a propaganda opportunity. A leaflet from the Masryonka, copied into Shlepnikov's memoir, was unequivocal. The government is guilty, it read. It started the war, and it cannot end it. It is destroying the country, and your starving is its fault. Enough! Down with the criminal government and the gang of thieves and murderers! Long live peace! If the weather had remained inhibitingly cold, if the city had received an adequate supply of flour, and even if the workplace toilets had been heated to unfreeze the pipes, the strikes might not have been so large. But on the morning of Thursday, the 23rd of February, the women in the Viborg cotton mills were in no mood for compromise. Their Women's Day meetings resulted in a mass walkout, and as they headed for the Neva, they called on other workers to march with them, including the men of the new Lesner and Ericsson factories. By noon, about 50,000 people had joined a protest on Viborg's main highway, Samsonievsky Prospect. "I was extremely indignant at the behaviour of the strikers," a Bolshevik from the Ericsson plant called Karanov recalled. "They were blatantly ignoring the instructions of the party district committees. Yet suddenly, here was a strike. There seemed to be no purpose in it, and no reason for it." A mile away from all of that, at an address on Serdobolskaya Street, Shlapnikov spent most of the day discussing party work with fellow members of the Bolshevik Russian Bureau. The meeting was not about the strikes and the members present. Still uncertain that the time was ripe for insurrection, were wary of encouraging a women's march. It was not until he attempted to make his way home that Shlapnikov began to see what he had missed. His number 20 tram was stuffed full of workers heading for the expensive Liteyny Quarter, and when it reached the Liteyny Bridge, it was surrounded by police. Barging aboard, they checked every passenger to weed out those whose hands and clothes looked work-worn. The idea was to keep the poor where they belonged, and make sure that their wretched protest could not interfere with decent life. The bridges were supposed to help protect the more expensive parts of town, but this time, thanks to the sub-zero cold, there turned out to be little point in raising them. An enterprising militant could simply walk across the ice. The first groups made their way from Viborg to the centre as the sun set over Petrograd on that first day. Later that evening, when he met Alfred Knox, who had become a major general since Milner's visit, the Duma industrialist Alexander Guchkov described the food shortage as the worst catastrophe his government had faced to date, more crippling and more dangerous than any battlefield defeat. He could already sense the trouble lay ahead. "Questioned regarding the attitude of workmen in the towns towards the war," Knox wrote, "Guchkov conceded that from 10% to 20% would welcome defeat, as likely to strengthen their hands to overthrow the government." The next day was a Friday, dull and foggy with cold rain. But neither the weather nor the appearance on the streets of Cossack horsemen, armed and grim, dampened the demonstrators' zeal. For Shlapnikov, events moved at a dizzying pace, not least because he still could not make sense of them. By late morning, nearly 75,000 workers from the Viborg district, two-thirds of its total workforce, had joined the strike. As marchers approached the Liteyny Bridge, Cossacks were arrayed against them. The lines of horses and the glint of steel must have been terrifying, but these agents of government turned out to share the workers' exasperation. For the first time that anyone could remember, the Cossacks cantered through the workers' lines, refusing to brandish their sabres or their whips. Meanwhile, in the Petrograd district, further demonstrations filled the streets. It was also here that the first bakeries were looted and food shops attacked. Before long, the disturbance had spread west to the dockyards and naval engineering works of Vasilevsky Island. The ministers had yet to respond to events. In the Taurid Palace, however, Duma members demanded to take control of the city's food supply in a last-ditch attempt to address the most immediate economic woes. On Saturday, a three-day general strike began. Among its leaders were members of the Mezrayonka and rank-and-file activists from the various left-wing groups, including, in defiance of Shlapnikov's Russian bureau, the Bolsheviks' own Viborg committee. All had worked throughout the night to spread the message and bring people out. And the morning felt like the start of a holiday. Trainloads of people, including families with children, streamed into the city from nearby industrial towns such as Sestroretsk. In Petrograd itself, working-class districts hummed with earnest preparation. The factories were silent, and there were no trams. But by 10 o'clock, the streets rang with the sound of marching feet and voices singing revolutionary songs. In all, over 200,000 people chose to march through Petrograd that day. White-collar workers, teachers and students joined the rising, and as they passed the wealthy homes, the marchers sometimes saw pale hands waving from an upper window. The protest had acquired a following of sorts in most sections of Petrograd society. But it was the workers in their padded sheepskin coats, some armed with knives or bags of nails, who took the lead when the time came to cross the ice. Their goal was Semyonskaya Square, where huge crowds had assembled by the early afternoon. Red banners stretched above the sea of heads, many with slogans that demanded peace, immediate and longed-for peace. Between the speeches, some enthusiasts began to sing the Marseillaise. In wartime Russia, this was treason and a breach of martial law. A number of demonstrators had prepared for the likely consequences by lining their hats with homemade metal shields and padding their jackets against the Cossacks' whips. For most, however, the crowd felt like protection in itself, the sense of justice and community, a shield in its own right. A little after 3 p.m., a mounted police officer called Krylov told his men to prime their weapons and disperse the mob. In the melee that followed, the Cossack horsemen charged the crowd. But it turned out, when they rode back and regrouped, that they had used their sabres on the police, not on the demonstrators. Krylov himself lay dead. For an hour or so, at least if they knew what had just happened, the people could believe in a forthcoming victory. But there were other confrontations between crowds and troops that day, and marchers and some bystanders were killed. No one was certain of the facts, for there were neither newspapers nor public telephones. When Tsukhanov and his Menshevik friends assembled at Maxim Gorky's flat that night, a rendezvous that they would use until the old regime collapsed, they blamed high-ranking Bolsheviks. Their flat-footedness, Tsukhanov wrote, or more properly, their incapacity to think their way into the political problem and formulate it, had a depressing effect on us. The intellectuals and writers in Tsukhanov's circle would find the next day even more distressing. Overnight, Khabarov had issued orders to turn the city into a military camp. At daybreak, the bridges were raised. Armed police and troops had mustered at the main junctions and squares, while Red Cross wagons, hitched to the rheumatic horses that the army did not want, waited to cart the wounded off to makeshift hospitals nearby. Khabarov's orders were to fire on any demonstrator who defied his order to disperse. A Bolshevik called Fyodor Raskolnikov, who was due to take his examinations as a naval officer at the time, remembered his walk to the barracks in the frost-hard early night. "Our company's quarters looked like an armed camp," he wrote. "Cartridge pouches were laid on the desks, and everywhere stood rifles with bayonets fixed. I found that the commanders of the classes had armed all the cadets." It did not take long for the youngsters in Raskolnikov's company to reject their commander's plans for them. By mid-morning, the young men had joined the crowds heading towards Nevsky Prospect, marching almost joyfully, their red banners held high. The hopes, the sunshine, and the comradeship contrasted with the ruler's cruel resolution. Police and members of the elite guards obeyed their officers this time and fired. The worst confrontation occurred on Semyonskaya Square, where at least 40 people were gunned down and many more were wounded. Panicked members of the crowd fled north, and by nightfall the square was silent. All that remained was trampled snow, a few alarmingly bright pools of blood, and a scattering of discarded caps, torn ribbons, and galoshes. The leaders of the underground parties were more convinced than ever now that it was time to stop the strikes. Shliapnikov still took the view that the working class would not win on its own. Without the army, it was powerless. Even the Vyborg Committee, so militant up to this point, agreed at its meeting, that night, that there was no choice but to bring the workers' movement to an end. Everyone was exhausted, however, and the Vyborg's comrade session dispersed without deciding how their decision was to be implemented. At Gorky's flat, Sukarnov and his friends could make no sense at all of the events. One story in particular, which Gorky heard when he telephoned Fyodor Shalyapin, the world-famous operatic bass, left him completely at a loss. Someone had seen an infantry unit firing systematically into the barracks of the elite Pavlovsky regiment. It was an act that looked like madness, and Gorky put the phone down on Shalyapin with a puzzled scowl. The truth would have amazed the most extreme of revolutionaries, for what had happened was a mutiny. In the confusion of that afternoon, a group of workers had informed cadets in the Pavlovsky's barracks that some of their fellows had fired on Russian civilians. Disgusted, a small group from 4th Company decided to revolt. They quickly settled on a slogan: "There is no cause for which we will allow our people's blood to stain the white tunics of the Pavlovskys." Then broke into a store and seized a number of rifles before setting out for the streets. Their mutiny was unsuccessful. When they were captured by the military police, Kabalov took charge of their punishment in person. But it signalled a changing mood in the ranks of the garrison, a taste for rebellion that was entirely independent of the Duma, the educated radicals, and any revolutionary cell. The demonstrations turned into a revolution on the 27th of February 1917. The Pavlovsky's defection had pointed the way. As Kabalov prepared to organise a second day of armed repression, full-scale rebellion broke out among the troops. The first to rise was the Volinsky Regiment, one of the units that had been deployed against the crowd the previous day. Sickened by what their comrades had been forced to do, a group of lads turned against their officers and marched out of the barracks yard, soon to be joined by members of the Litovsky and Ismailovsky regiments. Before long, even the crack Preobrazhensky regiment was dispersing into the streets. There was no turning back this time, for the rebels had shot some of their officers on the way out. Sukarnov, waiting by the telephone in Gorky's flat, gathered that by midday, at least 25,000 garrison troops had joined the revolutionary side. Young men with rifles now patrolled the streets, some lugging looted food across their backs. It also turned out that the workers had not followed their leader's advice about standing down. Overnight, there had been a raid on the armory in Lesnoy district, from which rifles, handguns, and ammunition had been seized to arm what was becoming an all-out anti-government revolt. The rising was neither blind nor anarchic. The workers chose their targets logically, storming the Kresty prison, the law courts, and the main artillery depot. When garrison mutineers turned up to liberate the prison, they appeared to be so calm and disciplined that the French military attaché, Colonel Averne, assumed they were acting on official orders. But the calmness was not universal. "In a short time," wrote a British witness, Stinton Jones, "the whole of the city was aglow with the glare from burning buildings, which, in addition to the heavy firing, made the situation appear far worse than it actually was." As he continued, "the mobs presented a strange, almost grotesque appearance. Soldiers, workmen, students, hooligans, and freed criminals wandered aimlessly about in detached companies, all armed, but with a strange variety of weapons. A student with two rifles and a belt of machine gun bullets round his waist was walking beside another with a bayonet tied to the end of a stick. A drunken soldier had only the barrel of a rifle remaining, the stock having been broken off in forcing entry into some shop. From his window on an upper floor, General Knox watched as the marcher swept towards the artillery department. "Craning our necks," he wrote, "we first saw two soldiers, a sort of advanced guard, who strode along the middle of the street, pointing their rifles at loiterers to clear the road. One of them fired two shots at an unfortunate chauffeur. Then came a great disorderly mass of soldiery, stretching right across the wide street and both pavements. They were led by a diminutive but immensely dignified student. There were no officers. All were armed, and many had red flags tied to their bayonets. Those red flags, mostly rags or scraps of ribbon, were soon blazing from every hat and rifle butt. Without one," Stinton Jones recalled, "it was policeman, spy, shoot him." The crowd's fear of police was justified, for through that day and well into the next, there were more fatal shootings of protesters. "As the streets cleared," wrote Jones, "little heaps, some very still, some writhing in agony, told of the toll of the machine guns." In working-class Viborg, the local Bolsheviks began to plan for an armed seizure of state power, the prelude to establishing a caretaker organization that they proposed to call the Provisional Revolutionary Government. Their leaders hoped to establish a headquarters at the Finland station, Viborg's obvious strategic heart. While the extreme left kept to Viborg, however, almost everyone else seemed to be heading for the Torried Palace, the home of the Duma. It was not clear what anyone expected to accomplish there. But the Torried was a hub of political authority and an obvious focus for revolutionary ambitions. The Tsar, based at his command center near the front, had been so alarmed by the messages from Petrograd that he'd ordered the Duma to be prorogued in the small hours that morning. By the time the soldiers, students and workers were converging on the Torried, many crammed aboard the cars that they had commandeered. There was no legal institution left to represent the will of their democracy. The only symbol anywhere was this palace, itself a throwback to the days of Prince Potemkin and the Empress Catherine the Great. The intruders made short work of the iron gates. To their surprise, however, as they stepped in from the wind and snow, the Torried felt deserted. The emptiness was deceptive. An effect of vastness on a scale that none had ever seen before. It took a lot to make this palace, an extravagance by 18th century Russia's richest man, appear crowded. The main ballroom, for instance, had been designed to accommodate 5,000 people, all of them dancing. Other chambers were a little smaller, but that still left space enough for each to have swallowed a circus, elephant and all. Sukarnov arrived in the early evening and noticed instantly how Torried staff, in their shirt fronts or black Cossacks, stood out from the newcomers in their greatcoats and fur hats. The palace had two massive wings joined in the centre by a domed atrium and columned hall, at the back of which, in what had been a winter garden, in the time of Catherine the Great, the Duma had its debating chamber. Most Duma officials also used offices in the building's right wing, and it was in one of these, as crowds surged into the main hall, that some of the dissolved parliament's leading members had gathered to talk. The gentlemen had no idea what they should do. To go on meeting when the Duma had been closed was an act of treason. But the majesty of the Constitution was easily forgotten at the sight of that crowd in the ballroom. For hours the politicians wrangled, uncertain even of their right to call for order in a city where a revolution had begun. That afternoon, with a certain reluctance, a group of them declared themselves to be the Provisional Committee of Members of the State Duma for the Restoration of Order in the Capital and the Establishment of Relations with Public Organizations and Institutions. As a right-winger called Vasily Shulgin had put it, "After all, if they did not take action, the scoundrels in the factories might well do so." The Duma Committee had no legal status, a fact that worried the lawyers in its ranks, but its members were national public figures, and included Mikhail Roshchenko, its chairman, Vasily Shulgin, Paul Milyukov, and a socialist called Alexander Kerensky. At least the office where they sat was quiet. The drama unfolding in the main hall was enough to terrify any monocle-wearing representative of the political elite. Paul Milyukov never forgot the sight of rough outsiders surging towards the ballroom and trampling on the hallowed parquet and the Persian rugs. "By nighttime," he wrote, "the Tauride was turned into an armed camp. The soldiers brought with themselves boxes of machine gun cartridge belts and hand grenades, and I think they also dragged in a cannon. When shots were heard somewhere around the palace, some of the soldiers began to run, broke the windows of the semicircular hall, and jumped out. Against the wall, all sorts of plunder was stacked up," explains a classic history of these events. "On a heap of sacks of barley and flour lay a carcass of a pig. The noise was incredible. The members of the Duma stood appalled at the gigantic crowds that had violated the Tauride Palace, and who were behaving as though it were the site of a great festival." The Tauride had begun to draw the entire city to its gates. "While the roadway of Shlapernyaya Street was occupied by demonstrators," remembered the naval cadet Raskolnikov, "its pavement was crowded with members of the intellectual and bourgeois public. In those days, every Philistine saw it as his duty to decorate his breast with a magnificent bow of red silk or calico." Some of these characters had come to stare. Raskolnikov recognized a gendarme with a red bow of colossal size. But others, also in white shirts and suits, had been dreaming of revolution all their lives. "I would do anything at all," Sukarnov vowed, as he rushed eastwards in the dusk, "so long as it was active, as any sort of cog in these events." By Monday evening, the Tauride was awash with public figures, including leaders of the workers' movement who had just been freed from Kretsy prison. Most socialists believed their task to be the convocation of a Soviet of workers' deputies, a truly democratic body that could represent revolution and begin to manage city life. Petrograd's hard-pressed population understood exactly what was meant. The original Soviet, in which Pavus and Trotsky had once starred, had been formed by the workers themselves at the height of the revolution in 1905. As they had then, the people started to elect new deputies from their own ranks, and it was established that the first of these should assemble in the Tauride at 7 o'clock that night. But someone had to find a meeting room. The Tauride central halls were packed, the noise impossible, but there were still spare officers in the left wing. Roshchenko was reluctant to let a rabble of this kind gather at all, but Kerensky persuaded him to let them have room 12, remarking that somebody must take charge of the workers. The famous Petrograd Soviet was born in Prince Potemkin's absurd barn of a palace that very night, and had immediately set to work. There were endless greetings to accept, and much applause. But there were also problems to be solved, from the food crisis to the uncontrolled dispersal of explosives. This was an emergency that called for practical measures, including the formation of some kind of militia to make the city safe. One of the Soviet's first acts was to elect an executive committee to take charge of its day-to-day affairs, a group soon known to everyone as the XCOM. While the workers' delegates filed in to join the crowd, this small group, mainly literary types, began to take command. The new chairman, Nikolai Chidze, was a Menshevik lawyer from Georgia and a former Duma man. Not noted for decisiveness, he was a respected but unexciting choice. "The best available," someone remarked, "since all the real heavyweights were still in exile or abroad." Other lawyers on the team included Matvei Skobelev, another Menshevik, while Sukhanov was elected in his capacity as a journalist. The Bolsheviks were represented on the ex-con by Alexander Shlapnikov, and another worker activist called P.A. Zalutsky. The most flamboyant member of the team, its vice chairman-elect, was none other than Alexander Kerensky, the gentleman already so involved with the Duma Committee and the palace's other wing. A native of Simbirsk, where his father had been one of Lenin's schoolmasters, and Protopopov had been a distant neighbour, Kerensky was a lawyer, with a florid taste in oratory and personal attire. Sukarnov, who had known him for some years, remembered a particular pair of silk slippers and a long kaftan. In February 1917, he was still pale and weakened after an operation to remove a kidney, but he threw himself into the revolution with impressive verve, accepting all the calls to serve like a diva with an unusually lavish haul of bouquets. Such drama was to be his trademark style. "He looks as if he were in pain," remarked Robert Bruce Lockhart, "but the mouth is firm, and the hair, cropped close and worn en brosse, gives a general impression of energy." Before the war, when he was an illegal revolutionary, Kerensky's nickname was Speedy, a reference to his habit of jumping on and off moving trams to evade the police. That Monday night, however, he did not show his nimble heels in the Soviet. The delegates would have had to make a pilgrimage across the hall to find him, for Kerensky was far less interested in the workers' plans than in his prospects on the Duma Committee. Events were moving very fast indeed. The Soviet had not even assembled when a student marched into the Tauride Circular Hall, leading a little group that consisted of two soldiers and a captured, trembling Tsarist minister. The imperial administration was dissolving. Its members had taken refuge in cupboards and cellars when the shooting started, but now they began to give themselves up. All afternoon, the revolutionaries made arrests, escorting one terrified old gentleman after another into the chaos of the Tauride Hall. By evening, the only place to keep the prisoners was the Duma's meeting chamber, a choice that had the advantage, from the Duma Committee's point of view, of keeping the socialist masses out of it. But neither inconvenience nor distraction hindered the ex-con. It began by considering the food crisis, the garrison, and how essential services might be restored. In a city deprived of reliable information, it also made plans to produce a newspaper, Izvestia, the first issue of which appeared the next morning. Across the hall, seated in greater comfort, but without the Soviet's obvious zeal, Rodchenko and his colleagues also talked well into the night. The arrest of the ministers had not been their initiative. When the first victim had been ushered in, Rodchenko had made an attempt to rescue him. And now they faced uncertainty and even ruin. "God knows what happened to the city," Rodchenko was to sigh. "All work has come to a halt, and we are supposed to be fighting a war." There were thousands of troops at the front, and no one could predict their reaction to the news from Petrograd. The question to be settled fast was who was meant to be in ultimate command. The Soviets' first session finally ended late that night, but Shlapnikov remembered that the Tauride was still buzzing like a hive at 4 o'clock in the morning of the 28th of February. Sukarnov was among those still inside. Picking his way around the unforgiving built-in seats and tables, the tired revolutionary found a quiet corner in the Duma chamber and lay down in his greatcoat. Through the glass roof above his head, he could make out the glow of many fires, and every few moments there rang out a distant shot. He fell asleep to the muffled conversations of groups of soldiers. His breath infused with damp wool and the tinned herring from which his neighbours were making a late supper. As soldiers in the Tauride licked the fish oil from their knives, the Tsar, at his headquarters near the front, was signing an order to crush the revolt at any price. In the light of Kabalov's obvious failure, he appointed a new man, General Ivanov, to do the job. No one had the least idea what might happen if this officer succeeded. Like almost everyone in Petrograd, however, Sukarnov remained euphoric. Stiff and exhausted from a night in his clothes, he woke on Tuesday in what he called the free city of the new Russia. He had barely opened his eyes when he noticed a group of soldiers tugging the hated portrait of Nicholas II from its frame. Later on, as he took a walk in the fresh air, his mind was shot through by luminous shafts of acute happiness, triumphant pride, and a sort of wonder before the boundless, radiant, and incomprehensible achievements of those days. The triumph belonged to the people. But it would be the Sukarnovs and Kerenskys, in the short term, who decided what should come out of it. The questions were urgent. The people loathed the Empress and her gang, but Nicholas was still the Tsar. The army at the front had sworn an oath to him, though it was not clear how long the soldiers might honour it. Meanwhile, whatever Ivanov might plan, someone had to make Petrograd safe for its inhabitants. Although the ex-com was already setting up militias for this purpose, the Duma committee was determined to take action of its own. On the 28th of February, Rodchenko issued an order for the troops in the capital to surrender their arms, intending to bring their revolt to an end and get the city on its feet. The move made the disorder worse, for soldiers feared courts-martial and the hangman's rope. Tense and hungry, they started planning further armed resistance in the streets. The Soviet backed them, especially as soldiers' deputies now outnumbered delegates from the factories in its plenary gathering. It was not clear which wing of the Taurid had control of the garrison. As a horrified Milyakov put it on the 28th of February, "There must be no dual power." The Bolshevik Viborg Committee had its own answer to that. Believing that the bourgeoisie would overturn hard-won new rights, it was still arguing that people should form a multi-party provisional revolutionary government through the mechanism of their own Soviets or workplace-based councils. Such bodies were already forming all around the city and elsewhere. But the obstacle was the ex-com, whose leaders refused to take up the reins of state. The Viborg Committee had a few sympathisers in the Taurid, but in Sukarnov's view, they merely chattered inaudibly and scribbled a bit. They did not even think of engaging in any real struggle for their principles. It was also clear that the Petrograd Soviet itself did not want power. Its members' hesitation was partly ideological, for most were Marxists, who believed that revolutions unfolded in fixed stages. What Petrograd had just begun, they argued, was a process to introduce a sort of parliamentary democracy, a system that they called the bourgeois phase. A workers' government, let alone full socialism, could happen only later, when the people had experience of democratic rule. As Alexander Potrasov, a Menshevik, had put it years before, at the moment of the bourgeois revolution, the class best prepared, socially and psychologically, to solve national problems is the bourgeoisie. Since anyone who thought about it would have dreaded taking power, the threat in this instance was expedient as well as beautiful. The prospect of ministerial office could have no appeal while Ivanov was closing in on Petrograd with his crack troops. The rest of the army, uniformed and armed, might side with anyone. Even the mutineers within it might turn against the revolution they had made, which was why the Soviet encouraged soldiers' deputies to dictate their own terms for restoring order among the capital's garrison troops. As Sukarnov explained, it was necessary to treat the garrison with the utmost delicacy and vital to create at all costs an undeniable authority it would consider its own and therefore obey. The Soviets' famous Order No. 1, issued in the confusion of the 1st of March, helped to bring down the rate of random shooting in the streets. Soldiers returned to their barracks, keeping their weapons, but observing discipline at work. In the long term, however, Sukarnov and his friends believed that the Soviet had to entrust power to the propertied elements, its class enemy. For that was the only way to protect and develop the gains of revolution. For him, the gist of the question was whether propertied Russia would consent to take power in such conditions. The Duma Committee, however, was as nervous of power as the Soviet. Though almost all its members had long been campaigning for change, they had never dreamed of disorder like this and disagreed among themselves about the sort of government they hoped to see. Left-wingers like Kerensky imagined a social democratic outcome. But there were others, including Milyukov, whose ideal was a British-style constitutional monarchy. The only point on which they all concurred was that the current position was illegal as well as dangerous. They had been cornered into shouldering responsibilities, but many ached to set them down. Both sides were trapped, and the only way out of their situation was to look for some kind of deal. The talks began in earnest on the night of the 1st of March. As Sukarnov had perceived, the task in hand was really to woo the Duma members into taking power despite themselves. From the Tauride's right wing, Milyukov was the main spokesman for the Duma Committee. It was clear that his principal anxiety was that the Soviet might make a condition that Russia should cease fighting at once, for peace had always been the workers' most urgent demand. That night, however, much to his relief, that disturbing idea was shelved, at least in the short term. Both parties also agreed that any government would be provisional, for they were all convinced that a permanent solution could be achieved only through free elections and the convocation of a constituent assembly, for which they would have to prepare. The Soviet knew that Milyukov was planning to revive the monarchy, but that issue was something that elected constitution writers could decide. Among the ex-con's few red lines was a stipulation that none of its members should serve as ministers in the temporary bourgeois government. Instead, they would devote themselves to promoting full workers' rights. The talks dragged on for hours, and in the end almost everyone, including Chidze and Kerensky, was actually lying down. The two sides might have been debating the conditions for a duel. When an agreement was finally concluded on the 2nd of March, it was largely because the Soviet ex-com had always wanted an excuse to capitulate. The deal created a provisional government with extensive powers, conceived as an assembly of upstanding citizens who could govern till elections could be called, and some more permanent regime agreed upon. Its chairman was to be an affable philanthropist from Moscow called Prince Georgi Livov, known for his fine work as an advocate of education, public health, and solid public services. Conveniently enough, the prince was not in Petrograd to consult face to face, but it was established by telegraph that he was ready to accept the role. Paul Milyukov, who was to be the country's foreign minister, was chosen to announce the news to the vast crowd in the ballroom. Milyukov had prepared a careful speech, but most of it was swallowed up by murmurs from the audience. He told them all that Prince Lvov had been selected as the leader of their government, describing him as a representative of Russian society, when a hostile voice interjected that Lvov represented nothing but propertied society. The former history professor bridled. "Propertied society," Milyukov insisted, "is the only organized society which can enable other strata of Russian society to organize themselves." It was the cue for an unfriendly but obvious question. "Who elected you?" "I could have written a whole dissertation," Milyukov's memoir explains. But instead, he chose to venture an audacious lie. "We were chosen," he shouted, "by the Russian Revolution." The crowd was not entirely persuaded, and there was more drama to come. Milyukov's group had wanted two members of the ex-com, Chidze and Kerensky, to serve as ministers. Chidze had refused straight away, citing the Soviet's judgment that workers' representatives could not be ministers, and declaring his intention to devote himself to the Soviet, the revolution's true spearhead. But Kerensky decided to accept the post of justice minister, vowing to serve the people until his last breath. "I speak, comrades," he told a spellbound gathering, "with all my soul, from the bottom of my heart. And if it is necessary to prove this, if you don't trust me, here and now before your eyes, I am ready to die." He was given an ovation, which he took to mean that he could act exactly as he chose. He disappeared into the Duma committee's chamber, leaving the XCOM leaders in a state of embarrassment, dejection, and fury. As Alfred Knox would later write, "Kerensky had all the theatrical qualities of a Napoleon, but none of his moral courage." A knot of bourgeois monarchists from the Duma committee had plans, meanwhile, where the Tsar was concerned. While all eyes were on the Tauride, the new war minister, Guchkov, accompanied by Shulgin, made a secret approach to Nicholas at his headquarters. The proposal Guchkov was carrying, which had Milyakov's fervent sanction, was that the Tsar should abdicate in favour of his younger brother, Mikhail Alexandrovich. In torment, Nicholas agreed. Though to protect his only son, a child whose health was always frail, he ruled the boy out of the succession at the same time. On the 2nd of March 1917, the reign of Nicholas II came to an end. If Mikhail Alexandrovich had not refused the throne, Kerensky called his act the highest patriotism, Russia might have had to choose between a constitutional monarchy and a lethal crisis. The revolution had not matured enough by this stage for anyone to decide exactly what form Russia's government should take, but large numbers of citizens were clearly finished with all czars. The British ambassador applauded Kerensky for attempting to calm the rage of Soviet republicans when the news of Guchkov's mission eventually leaked out. Conservatives and monarchists, however, were disgusted. As Palaiolog confided to his diary, not quite understanding what was going on, "Fear of the jailbirds, who are in command at the Finland station and the fortress, has compelled the representatives of Duma to give way. The Soviet is now master." The more accurate diagnosis was that Milyakov's nightmare had come to life. The people remained loyal to their Soviet, while an unelected and reluctant provisional government wielded an untried but theoretically limitless authority. Russia faced the prospect of long-term dual power. The abdication created a republic. The jubilation in Petrograd streets drowned out the murmured doubts and fears. But no one knew how the army as a whole was likely to regard the new regime, nor what might happen in the empire's many cities and towns. Even the people who had made the revolution, the factory workers with calloused hands, the women in patched coats and grubby winter scarves, were not sure who had really won. As Sukarnov left the Tauride at 6 o'clock on the 2nd of March, he was seized by members of the crowd and pressed to make some kind of speech. "They wanted news," he explained, conceding that the speaker they were really after was Kerensky. "I was taken by the arms and dragged out into the street. From the steps, I saw a crowd, the like of which I had never seen before in my whole life. There was no end of faces and heads turned towards me. They completely filled the courtyard, then the street, holding up banners, placards, and little flags." It was snowing, and the light had already begun to fade. The people were exhausted, and Sukarnov's weary voice was thin. "But, as far as the eye could see, they were all straining towards me with a tense and death-like silence."